My name is Sarah Kay, and I am the author of A Little Daylight Left.
April is National Poetry Month, and we're starting the celebration with a conversation with Sarah Kay about her new collection, A Little Daylight Left. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's our conversation. So you are the author of four other books of poetry. Can you give our listeners a description of this collection, A Little Daylight Left?
Sure. This is my first poetry collection in 10 years. And so it feels a little bit like my debut grown-up poetry collection. And this particular collection has ended up being a little bit of a documenting of the moments in my life that I have reached for poetry. And it turns out that the reasons I have reached for poetry and the moments that I have reached for poetry are vast and has changed over my living, but the reaching has not. And the reaching turns out to be maybe one of the earliest parts of me. And apparently is something that is fundamental to my person. And so the book chronicles these different moments and reasons that I have reached for poetry in my life.
I kind of have a couple of follow-ups there because I'm wondering, like, what makes a collection? Is it a theme? Is it quantity of work? When do you decide, okay, I have enough for a collection, and these are the poems that are going in this collection?
Well, in my case, I fell in love with poetry not in a book, but in a dive bar. When I was a teenager, I grew up in New York City, and I accidentally stumbled into a dive bar that hosted live poetry, open mics, and poetry slams, which were competitions for live poetry. And I was so enamored with that space. And I think most of all, the way that poetry, which I once thought was only a solitary art form and still can be, but I learned in that space that poetry could also be a communal art form, that really moved me and really excited me. And I loved what happened when I shared a poem in a room with people. And so for a long time, that was a big part of my love of poetry, so much so that I wasn't really drawn to making books. That felt like a whole other realm that I wasn't as, you know, excited about. But I have been writing poems my whole life. And when I got the opportunity and the challenge to put a new collection together on paper, it was really exciting to sift through all of these poems that I had written for myself and for different moments and different personal challenges and see, yeah, where the themes were, where a story could be found if you read the poems in a certain order, and also what could happen when I did put the words on paper, which was just a new set of challenges for me.
You know, I asked about theme because these poems, you said they reflect when you reached for poetry, and they did seem to be working through, at least from my perspective, you know, a lot of angst. You write about 9/11 and possible abuse and the time we have left with friends and heartbreak. Are there poems that didn't make the cut for this collection because they just didn't have the right feeling or atmosphere about them?
Definitely, there were lots of poems that didn't make this collection. There were 10 years worth of poems that didn't make this collection. But I think what I noticed is the book is divided into three sections. And the first section is sort of orbiting, reaching for poetry as I emerged out of childhood, which in my case corresponded with the introduction of violence into my consciousness. And that includes my proximity to Ground Zero, as a young person, and also interpersonal violence and also gendered violence. And so that first section, I think, marks the chronology of reaching for poetry to help me process violence. And then that second section, it turns out that I spent a lot of time reaching for poetry to help me process love and heartbreak and searching, sometimes for love and sometimes for purpose and sometimes for adventure. But that's that second section. And then that third section, I think, shows the moments in which I reach for poetry to help me process aging and mortality. And so the poems that ended up in the collection are ones that fit those, I don't want to say like reasons for poetry, but at least in my life, like I have used poetry to do a lot of things. And it turns out I have used poetry to help me process experience and feeling and confusion and transition. And so when there were poems that I could see the chronology of that processing, that's what I chose to include in the collection. And then there is sort of a storyline if you read through. And so I wanted to give readers an arc to follow. I didn't want there to be redundancies. You know, I have written so many poems about the same topics, but I often ask myself, okay, which is the poem that really gets at, you know, this particular experience or confusion or question, and then let me allow that poem to stand on its own in this collection.
You know, I experienced this collection both on the page and in audio form. I do it simultaneously. And you read the poems in the audiobook, and they were either read in studio or there were several that were recordings from a live reading that occurred in January. Is that right?
That's right.
You know, when you say that you first experienced poetry in a dive bar, it kind of changes what I'm asking from this question a little bit, because I was going to ask you about that experience of both voicing your own audiobook, but then also the live recording. Which one did you feel more comfortable with? I kind of have a feeling that it was the live recording.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, my favorite way to encounter poetry is in a room full of other people. And I love the experience of hearing how the poem is landing. You know, one of the reasons why I requested to be allowed to do a live audiobook show for some of these poems is because I think a lot of times when people are reading poetry, they don't always know they're allowed to laugh. And even if you just heard my voice in a studio, I don't know if you would know you're allowed to laugh. But when you hear that poem out loud in a room full of people who are all laughing, then you go, oh, this is funny. I'm allowed to laugh at this. And that felt helpful to me. In art making, I love when a piece of art justifies the form that it's in sometimes explicit, but also sometimes almost fully subconscious ways, right? Like one of my favorite experiences is reading a book, and there's some part of me that goes like, oh man, this would not work as a movie. It can only work as a book. Like that feels really good, you know? And there's something about poetry that I perform in a room full of people that I think I get an access to what my face is doing, what my voice is doing, what my body is doing, the jokes I get to tell around the poem, the way I contextualize it for the room, that there's some part of a person's brain that's listening that feels like, oh man, I really had to be here for this. And I love that feeling. I love creating that feeling for somebody. And I'm used to that. That's the part of poetry that I come from is I'm thinking about when I'm standing in a room full of people, how to create a night for them that is fun and exciting and meaningful and challenging in different moments. And how can I signal to their brains, like, oh, you really had to be here for this? Obviously, in a book, I'm doing something different, and there's a different set of tools and paintbrushes that I get to use in terms of what do the words look like on the page, and how does a person hear it in their head when they read through it? How are their eyes moving across the page? There's so many different things to consider, which was exciting to me. But it was newer. The newest version, the newest challenge was reading this in a studio to nobody that I hadn't done before.
Well, I have an example of the live poetry reading, so let's take a listen.
I realized that poetry has played a lot of roles in my life. It's my craft, it's my hobby, it's my profession, it's my community, but maybe more than anything else, it's my compass, and I follow it and have. And by following poetry, that is what has led me to all of these surprising people in all of these corners of the world I would never have found otherwise. And that's such a magical thing to get to have. So I was thinking about the people and the places that I have found through following poetry. And I was thinking about, like, how did I learn that? Where did that come from? Someone had to give me permission to do that. And so I wrote this poem. Orange. The monks who are waiting at my gate at JFK might not be monks, but they are all wearing orange robes, orange sandals. They are rolling orange carry-on bags. And one of them even has an orange neck pillow already on his shoulders in preparation for this flight to Dallas. I know the rules about photographing people you don't know, but forgive me, I snapped the shot so I can send it to my mother and make her day. My mother won't say that she gave up photography to raise children, but it is true that she used to be a professional printer with a life of image making. And then stopped to fill her arms with babies, and then toddlers, and then children, and then the things teenagers handed her when we refused to be held any longer. You might think that a woman who spent hours inhaling chemicals and grueling over various sinks and under various lights to create a perfectly balanced image would begrudge a technology that imitates it. But you haven't met my mother. This is a woman who loves New York more than she loves any human alive or dead. Every day, she walks through the same shitty city as the rest of us. But when I return with a mouth full of complaints about the weather, the subway, the tourists, she remains an endless scroll of wonders, of things she insists could only happen in New York. So, when my childhood friend James teaches her to use the app we all use, she isn't angry, but amazed. This would have taken so much work in the dark room, she says. Now it's just a button. It's like magic. When James and I were little, his favorite color was orange, and my mother loved this fact. Found it strange and marvelous, this little boy willing to forego fire trucks and Power Rangers, claiming the untouched reject of the crayon box, preferring the traffic cone, the citrus fruit, to practice using the app and get her photography sea legs under her again. She photographs orange objects around the house and on the street. She only has two followers, me and James. But every caption is the same. Orange for James. And she wanders the city as wide-eyed as always, stopping strangers with, "Excuse me, I noticed your wonderful orange bag. Your hat. Your construction vest. That's my nephew's favorite color. May I photograph it? Never mind that he isn't her nephew. Never mind that it makes him sound 6 and not 30, which he is. This is the way she has always moved through New York, in search of bright morsels she can bring home to share. In Dallas, I wait for my bag at the carousel, and a man in a corduroy jacket approaches, asks me if I am Sarah Kay. When I say yes, he says, "My priests know your poetry and thought that it was you. motions over his shoulder to the men in orange behind him. But when I wave, he says, "I'm sorry. Because of their religious vows, they are not permitted to communicate with someone of your gender, but they asked me to tell you that they wish you continued success." Days later, a new email through my website. "We hope to have not offended you by not meeting in person to appreciate your work, and also pray that your poetry lights up minds, smiles, and souls of all those searching for meaning, that your beauty with words be not just a trained art, but a reflection of who you wish to be." And then an offering of a poem in Sanskrit, which roughly translates, "On bearing fruits, trees bend, become humble with newly gathered water, clouds hang very low. This is the nature of the benevolent." I used to think this was a story about coincidence, or a story about the invisible thread of poetry that so many people are holding on to, even and especially people who may not have anything else in common. But I think it is actually a story about my mother, how she didn't have to take a photograph for 30 years to make a camera of a daughter, or at least teach her that the way you notice can be a weapon or an act of love. That color blooms through every city, whether you see it or don't, whether you seek it or don't. So why not seek? Why not see? Why not ask yourself, who am I looking for?
Well, I do want to talk about structure and what the poem looks like on the page, because, you know, I noticed a couple of the poems. One was, "I am 17 and everyone," and also "The Church of Coupledom." You know, the lines would start left justified, and then they would shift to right justified. And sometimes they would actually shift back and forth. So talk to me about this structure and perhaps how the reader should approach this.
Oh, how fun. I never get asked about structure on the page. This is a very fun question. I think Patricia Smith is a poet whose work I have admired for a long time. And I one time got to hear her give a craft talk where she spoke about the left-hand margin as like the trunk of a tree and the right-hand margin as the branches that come away from the trunk. And so when she was writing poems in this particular moment that I heard her speak, she was thinking about all of the words that run down the left-hand side and then all of the words that run down the right-hand side and really taking into consideration, you know, both sides of the line. And it made me think about what our connotation is with left-justified text versus what our brain does when it sees right-justified text, and especially in one poem or in one page, your brain, even without knowing what the poem is about, I think as a reader, you start out on the left justified and you go, "I know what this is. I am familiar. We are in the realm of prose and that feels comfortable and safe. And here I am." And then all of a sudden your eyes are being pulled away and into a world that feels like the rules are breaking and it's unfamiliar and it's perhaps a new world or perhaps a new way of considering the world that we have left. And so I like using what a reader's perhaps past experience with reading is to decide what hints I can give them just based on what they're seeing.
I noticed there were some other poems where instead of reading, you know, like an enjambed line, there might just be a large gap in the line. And I personally have not seen that before, although I think the Kaveh Akbar poem at the beginning was also structured in that same way. Can you talk to me about that style? And I should know that it has a name, but I don't.
No, why? Listen, there's no need to know the vocabulary to still be able to encounter it. and feel what it feels like. My friend, I think Nate Marshall is the one who I first heard, or maybe Ocean Vuong, I think, is the one who says, like, do you have to understand the rain or can you go stand in it? And I feel that way about poetry too sometimes. But I do think the technical word of that space is a caesura.
Oh, yeah, I
And
have heard that before.
yeah, and the poet whose work has influenced me the most in terms of caesura use is probably Safia El-Hilo, who's a Sudanese American poet whose work I love. And she's a master of the caesura. When she uses that, it's with such precision. And so truly, I'm just, putting on my Safia costume to give it a try when I do it. But it has to, for me, the times when I employ caesura is about pacing and is about how quickly your eyes move through text as a reader. And if I want your eyes to slow down and I want you, it takes a second for you to move from this word to the next because I have put space there. I think it's telling you a little bit about how slow I need you to go here. And so that first poem you're talking about is a pretty short poem, and it would be very easy to speed through it very quickly. But the poem is also specifically about not speeding through the beauty that the world keeps putting in front of me and the way that I keep getting stuck on beauty. And so I think forcing a reader to keep getting stuck on the words before they get to the next word was helpful to me.
I noticed that you do not use the word and, but instead use an ampersand. Can you talk to me about that?
I love that you I love that you asked about that. I love the ampersand. I just think it's aesthetically beautiful. I think as a kid, I practiced drawing it when I learned it. I just thought it was so fancy and impressive. Why use three letters when I can use this gorgeous symbol instead? And there is something about having the world of these poems feel like one full world that we step into when we step into the book. That I enjoyed. And so I do like that in this book, in this world, that symbol is important and consistent. And it's connective, right? That's the whole point of that symbol, is it's connecting one thing to another, like a little link. And so I like that symbolically, having a symbol for connection and connectedness be throughout.
Are those who only listen to the poem missing something of that symbol?
Maybe, but those who only listen to the poem are then getting something that the people looking on the page don't get either. And that's fine. I'm not precious about my poems. I write my poems because I need to write them. And I write lots of poems, and many of them never see anybody else's eyes but mine. And then sometimes there's something about a poem that pulls it farther into the world, whether that's on page or on stage. And as soon as the poem leaves my hands, it belongs to other people. And that's the greatest gift of all, the fact that other people want to read these words and find their own relationship to them is so exciting to me. So, if the person who is reading this on the page gets to muse over the caesuras and the ampersands, and the person who is listening on audiobook gets to hear a room full of people laughing, like each of those groups of people, I want them to receive these gifts that I have placed in the poems for them specifically. And there's no wrong way to encounter poetry. It's the way that is right for you in your life right now.
Can you talk to me about the illustrations throughout the book?
Oh, sure.
Seashells, I think, make a recurring appearance. And I saw a mention of it, Sophia Janowitz, in the acknowledgments. Talk to me about that.
Sure. So when I was 3 months old, my mother had me in a baby snuggly on her chest, walking through her local bodega. And a woman walked up and peeked in the snuggly and said, "How old is that baby?" And my mom said, "3 months." And the woman said, "So is mine. Should they be friends?" And it worked. And so Sophia Janowitz and I have been best friends since we were 3 months old, which means we quite literally, with no exaggeration, learned to speak to each other and with each other. And I like to say that we've been having one ongoing conversation ever since. And when we were kids, she's this incredibly talented visual artist. And when we were kids, kind of our way of playing is I would, ramble stories and poems in her direction, and she would translate them into whimsical, beautiful drawings and doodles. And we have just continued that collaboration into adulthood. And so every book project I've ever attempted, she has provided the most beautiful drawings and illustrations. And not only is she just a very talented artist, there's also probably no one on the planet who is more familiar with my poems. She has read every version of every draft just by virtue of being my best friend who I share things with. And so, for example, in this book, we didn't think we were going to get the chance to have any drawings in it because it was our first time working with like a big time grown up publisher like Penguin Random House. And so we thought, oh, well, probably they don't want drawings in here, and that's okay. And then someone in the maybe the marketing department or something in a me early meeting, they were like, "Hey, we noticed that all of Sarah's previous books have drawings in them. Is she gonna do that for this book?" And we were so excited. We said, "Absolutely. You want drawings? We got drawings." And so it was really fun to get to collaborate with her on this as well, especially because the book ended up somewhat accidentally having like a little bit of a memoiristic shape to it. And it's not, full autobiography, but there's certainly you're working through a timeline of living. And therefore, this person who has been present for the timeline of my living, for her to be the one finding images to place inside the book felt perfect.
Before I started reading your poetry, I read the epigraph at the beginning of the collection. Can you talk to me about what you chose?
Sure. Yeah. The first quote is from the poet Laura Lamb Brown Lavoie. And the second one is by Ocean Vuong. And I loved the way these two lines are from two separate writers in two separate poems, but next to each other, they really felt in conversation, so much so that if you read them one after the next, it sounds like they were born to be next to each other. And so the lines are, "There are enough ballrooms in you to dance with everyone you'll ever love." And then, "And remember, loneliness is still time spent with the world." And the true story is that those are two lines of poetry that I have held onto and carried with me for years. And when my editor said, "Do you want an epigraph for this book?" I hadn't planned on an epigraph. And then those two lines just were so clearly appropriate to this book project, and also authentically the lines that reverberate in my head forever and ever. Also, I'm not the tattooing type personally, but I am on record as saying if I were the tattooing type, it would probably be one of those two lines.
I read that you are the founder of Project Voice. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. Project Voice is an initiative that is dedicated to bringing poetry into education spaces. And so we are a team of poets who travel from school to school to school, performing poetry and helping facilitate poetry writing and poetry workshops with young people, and then also sometimes professional development with educators to help them figure out how they can use poetry in their curricula and in their classrooms. So that is the work that I have done now for a very long time. And I was on the road full-time for almost a decade, traveling around the country and also outside the country to share poems with people and help them get excited about poetry and talk about what poetry is and what it can be, and mainly try to help people see that there is room for them in poetry.
The publication of this collection coincides with the kickoff of National Poetry Month.
And also accidentally April Fool's Day. It is not an April Fool's joke. It is a real book, and it is really coming out, I promise.
Do you have a hope for readers of this book? Is there something you would like for them to take away from your poetry?
Oh, it is such an honor to me that people spend time with poetry at all, and then my poetry especially. And I think what poetry has done in my life when I read other people's poetry is sometimes I read a poem and I realize that somebody found language for something I did not even know I needed language for, but thank God they found it. And now I don't have to. I just get to visit their language that they found, and I get to luxuriate in it and live in it for a moment. And sometimes I get to pass it on to somebody else who I know needs this language right now. And so, you know, the most ambitious hope I have, I guess, is that there is some language in this book that someone arrives to and is provided with language for a feeling or an experience that they didn't know they needed language for. But a less ambitious hope, which is still a valid one, is just that people enjoy the book, and that perhaps, especially people who maybe don't even think that poetry is for them, or that they have experienced feeling excluded by poetry, my hope is that they will not feel excluded as they move through this book, that there is a welcoming into poetry that is important to me, that I'm always trying to work on. Beyond the project of this book specifically, a project of my work and my living has been trying to welcome people into poetry, because at a very crucial moment in my life, I was welcomed into poetry and people made room for me in the House of Poetry, and it gave me a direction to move. And so I am also always trying to welcome people into poetry. And in order to do that, I like to try to think of all the possible doors there could be. Are you the kind of person who might pick up a book with a beautiful cover? I got you. Are you the type of person who would absolutely not pick up a book of poetry, but might listen to an hour of audio? I got you too. Are you a person who would do neither of those things, but might watch a YouTube video of a live performance? Boom. Is that not your thing, but maybe you'd watch some animation? I've got a couple of those. That's why when I say there's no wrong way to meet poetry, it's just like there's so many different poets, there's so many different kinds of poetry, there's so many different approaches to this art form. And I'm confident that there is a poem for you out there. It might be in my book, but it also might not be. And I'm excited to help fling open a lot of doors so that people can find their way in.
Well, the collection is A Little Daylight Left. Sarah Kay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sarah Kay, author of the book A Little Daylight Left, which was published by The Dial Press. The audio excerpt is courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio from A Little Daylight Left by Sarah Kay, read by the author. Copyright 2025 Sarah Kay. Sound recording copyright 2025 Penguin Random House, LLC. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.